This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 358, Metaversing. Hello and welcome again to yet another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin, one of your three co-hosts, joined by, funny enough, two other co-hosts who are also probably as excited as I am to be here today. Mr. Rowe, how are you doing this fine day?
I am just fine. I was checking your math. If you were one of three, there would be two other. Yes, you're correct.
Oh,
I am
good. Well. Yeah, just making sure, you know, sometimes like fingers, toes, whatever.
Yep, I'm really excited also to be here with our third co-host. That would make me the second, but we're all co-hosts, so we're equally co'd. Andy Piper.
What?
Hey, Andy.
No.
So that makes me three of three. So am I a Borg? Do we like have a little Borg sphere scout ship?
Seven of nine.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. I mean,
we could.
They do operate in threes normally, I think. So yeah, could be three of three.
Well, how does seven of nine work then?
Because there were nine, so that's a multiple of three.
Oh,
that's three of three. That's three times three. Yeah.
I don't know. I might be wrong.
Oh, okay.
Might
so it's like a pod, mistaken. Right? So
yeah.
Groups of three.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, now that we've straightened that out.
Well, so we're talking about threes. So our first article here is a interesting World Economic Forum article. I actually didn't see if this was in Davos this year because there wasn't exactly like a lot of things going on in person in Davos. But there are three technologies that are arguably going to shape the metaverse. And this is where we wanted to start talking about because metaverse is a product or service. Metaverse is a place. Oh, and an interesting one here for me is metaverse is a moment.
Go on.
Where I was playing with this a little bit last week, so I had a chance to give a bit of a talk at a local hackathon. And I did speak on the point of metaverse as an entity,
right?
So okay. Probably more of a place, right? In the way this is kind of segmenting things into three,
mm-hmm.
As a place where people can connect and people can do things. And I made the point, at least my funny version of this is it the metaverse? Is it a metaverse, mm-hmm. one among many? Is it Meta's verse? That I thought I was clever with that one. And then I was like, no, it is the metaverse. It's one place that's intended to be one place for everything, one ring to rule them all and in the darkness bind them.
Kind of like the universe is the combined everything.
Yes, yes. So I see it very heavily as a place. I can see it as a platform upon which products and services can be offered,
right?
But not in so much as a product of it in and of itself, much like the internet is not a product except for when it goes down due to a carrier and your entire neighborhood is shut down and you got to drive around to find some cup of Wi-Fi at a local grocery store or something like that.
Then an access service is down, but the internet is still not down because the internet's whole point is that it routes around the problems when the things go down, right?
Exactly. Except for the situation where, and from my personal experience, for me, the internet was unavailable. But as you said, Michael, the reason for that wasn't because the internet being down, it was the access provider that exactly. didn't have the connection for me. So I like the place concept. I'm not so sure I buy the product or service notion.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because in this article, it talks about the metaverse as a place where users can interact and transfer their information across multiple digital locations. So they actually see those products or services, so Roblox or Fortnite or whatever, as digital locations inside of the metaverse rather than... So they're not themselves a metaverse. They are part of a bigger metaverse. Those are locations within a metaverse. Now, I find this article interesting because Towards the top of the webpage, there's a link to related articles, and it talks about there's a link to one about why you can't have the metaverse without a blockchain. Further down in this story is a chart by from Bitcraft Ventures, which is a classic trough of disillusionment, slope of enlightenment, plateau of productivity curve. And it refers to extended reality, metaverse brackets, Web3 technologies versus mature platforms, internet brackets, Web2 technologies. And in neither of those cases does it talk about blockchain. And if you look at some of the stuff, I keep coming back to the difference of opinions, or maybe there's a convergence but hidden of opinions between whether Web3 refers to the metaverse and 3D engines and interactions and spaces more than it refers to, as opposed to the blockchain and all of the services that are being built up around the marketplace around the blockchain. And I find there's a couple of things I've been looking at this week where the metaverse, sorry, no, not the metaverse, the Web3 stack has been very, very heavy on building stuff up around the blockchain and gas costs and all of those kind of things that you need to connect and create new objects. But this story is clearly much more about virtual reality, and I think it's got much less of a dependency on the blockchain as something that underlies it all. Because we didn't have that when we were doing Second Life, right? We weren't thinking in those terms at all. We were beginning to think about some of the challenges that blockchain helps us to address around permanence of ownership.
Digital
right,
goods.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We were starting to think about that stuff, and certainly they were a big challenge to the economy of those spaces. But it's, yeah, I just find it, I don't think there's an agreement on this topic. And I actually think there's probably more disagreement on this topic than there is agreement.
Well, the one thing that I remember thinking about back in those days, not just the ownership of digital goods, but about micropayments, and the fact that from a business financials perspective, it was not cost effective to have every transaction going back to a traditional banking model, because the incremental charge cost was significantly too high, right? And by the blockchain angle, which is really designed to handle micropayments, because you're talking about a piece of a coin of some sort, the whole idea behind micropayments kind of gets moved aside, because you're now not dealing with, I'll say it, real money. You're talking about a digital currency that only has value as an investment, or when you take the money and you put it into a fiat currency that can be used for spending outside of a traditional digital currency exchange model.
Now, I think there is a ton of stuff here in this article and connections in this article to lots of things that we've spoken about over time. And one of the other interesting aspects of this, which I think Michael Rowe you'll find particularly interesting, is at the end of it, where it starts talking about brain-computer interfaces and OpenBCI. And I haven't come across OpenBCI, at least in its current form. So I clicked through to that website to look, and they've got some renderings and images of their non-invasive electrode-based headsets that do things like enabling people to, you know, use, well, they're talking about the operating system of the mind and things like that. And I think that's really, really interesting as well, sort of that whole immersive kind of potential.
Yeah, I had not clicked through to the OpenBCI article.
Yeah, it looks like aspect. The kind of thing you used to play with.
It's, I still have two different ones here at the house. this is interesting. I mean, it really looks, I guess, as you say, it's an open platform for this. And I could easily see how you could print a lot of the scaffolding, maybe not all the details of the components, but really, really.
Well, if you scroll,
give me something to read this
if
weekend.
You scroll down to the Galea section, which is about halfway down that page, where they've got a rendering of a VR headset which has the neurotechnology built into the straps, etc. It gets really interesting. So, and they've got a relationship with Valve and Steam there. So there's some fascinating future stuff there.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting.
Good.
Okay, so now you've booked my weekend for me.
So slightly related to all this too, which I also find really interesting, is that, yes, we've been around this for a while. Yes, we've got lots of material discussions around it. Yes, you might argue we were ahead of our time. And there's a notion that with that perspective and where we see various hype cycles and curves from various companies, you know, are we still ahead of our time here or not? The intriguing thing that I'm reflecting on is this past week, and in the U.S. here, was our lovely Super Bowl. There's always lots of commercials that are announced directly for the Super Bowl, and one of them came from Salesforce. And the Salesforce example says, we don't need to be in Mars or the metaverse. The action is happening right here, right now, with real people. And so it was intriguing. I'll find a copy of that to put that in the show notes too. That voiceover was happening with a bunch of people walking down the street wearing VR headsets, which obviously, you know, hopefully there are cameras in them too, so they don't fall in a hole.
Talking of, are we still
ahead of our time here? You know, because those killer apps aren't exactly in place.
Well, we're still in relation to the wearables here, aspects of what we've just been talking about. There's two things here. One of them I think is going to be just a quick hit, and then in the following one is probably something that might want to talk about a bit longer. But the first of these articles from The Verge is about Motorola having come up with a 5G neckband that goes along with your glasses, but actually hangs around your neck and has kind of got the bulky part of the mechanism. Presumably, it actually shows you here the battery, a touchpad, a SIM card, and so on. Those are in a box that basically sit on your chest underneath a lanyard. So,
well, it's actually even more than that, right? Because it's the full computer. That's the problem with most of your wireless or independent headsets, is they're so heavy and bulky on the face. This moves that weight, and it's actually it's on both sides. It's behind you and in front of you. The picture only shows it on the chest.
Interesting.
And so it distributes the weight. It allows you to have a much more powerful experience, non-tethered experience, right? Without having a big, bulky, heavy device on your face, which is the challenge with a lot of your AR, VR headsets right now, is they either require you to be tethered to something, or they're big, bulky, heavy, or not as powerful.
Well, we're talking of things that affect your face, and more specifically, Michael Martin's eyes.
Yes.
This is a story that I think we've all shared between ourselves this week and boggled about. I've certainly talked to my wife about it in some detail.
Me too.
Again, from The Verge, about a company called Second Sight. Interestingly, from a sort of terminology perspective, and second life and second sight and all kinds of opportunities outside of the human body. They developed some technology to partially restore aspects of sight, so enabling people to get some implants that would give them grayscale or some element of their sight back. And that company, unfortunately, went bankrupt and has left all of these people with no recourse to sort of service or anything for their implants, which is scary.
I actually heard about this, not only seeing it online a couple of places, I actually heard about it on NPR this week too. There was a discussion. They had about 300 customers using this, and the implants themselves were, I think, $150,000 or $250,000, right? So if you can imagine being completely blind, and this gives you some level of sight back, the ability to distinguish, you know, grayscale shapes, so you could actually have some level of independence, and then to have that taking away from you, it was a couple of years ago that this bankruptcy started. They stopped creating new versions. They said they would support the ones they had. If I remember correctly, there's been an acquisition They went through a bankruptcy or were starting one. The CEO and multiple people left. People have gone to really finding others who have the device who aren't using it in order to retrofit failing devices. And now the question is, what do you do going forward? And when I saw this article, the part that really got me was the precedent of a medical device, right? A life-saving medical device. What is the responsibility of the company that sells it to have long-term maintenance?
Well, there's an interesting...
Even if they're going out of business, what's the handoff to another group that would then potentially be able to support this? Because these are life-changing for the people who need them, and now they're regressing back, right?
So this is fascinating because only last month here in the UK, there was a story from... this was a story from the NHS iHospital that actually undertook the procedure about an 88-year-old woman who has received a retinal implant, not too dissimilar to what is being described by from the private company Second Sight as a solution to those patients. And they are currently trialing this here in the UK, evidently, because they've had geographic atrophy, so their vision is deteriorating. And they've got these special glasses. Again, it's very similar to the image you see on the Verge article, where they've got these special glasses that basically enables them to get some additional information. But so having been through that experience in one place in the world, and in fact I've just done some research, and it looks like that Second Sight technology was being talked about back in 2009 originally, before they actually brought it to market. There were stories about it, and to see it then being used afresh, literally, as a new thing, being described as a revolutionary thing here in the UK, you have to wonder about things like lifespan for those kind of devices when you've got a human life involved in really tied up and bound up with it.
You put into perspective, this is a life-changing event, right? So it could be life-saving to some, but it certainly is life-changing for the better. And so the thing that struck me was when you apply the same concept to other implantable devices, the augmented human as opposed to augmented reality, although that's a reality for the human, could be a pacemaker, could be a whole range of different things that are truly directly impacting whether someone lives or doesn't. Is there a responsibility for the various and sundry organizations that certify these kinds of implantable devices to hold the code in escrow?
That's exactly where I was going to go. I think about systems that we have today in an enterprise world just to manage assets, right? And you sell a big enough deal and you've got to have code in escrow, because the customer may use this system for 20 to 40 years, even though the code, is designed modern today.
I'm going to propose that we skip ahead in our show list here of things, stories we were going to talk about, just because I think it connects quite nicely to what we were just talking about in a different context. And something that I came across this week and shared with you both was the Video Game History Foundation making an announcement, or making a statement, on the fact that Nintendo have announced that they're closing down the digital game stores for the Nintendo 3DS and Wii U at the beginning of next year, I believe. I think it's in 2023 anyway. I'd have to recheck. But these are totally different in terms of qualities of life and impacts on people's lives, in terms of one being directly related to your body and existence.
Could be mental health.
It could be, absolutely. But what you just said, Michael, around the code potentially being in escrow, having ways to access, maintain, or maybe open source, whatever that may look like, that's one way of doing things. The video gaming companies are being called out here by the Video Game History Foundation for basically shutting these things down. People saying, well, okay, what about my games? They're not going to be playable anymore because they can't ping the server, not because they need to be online, because the games are online, but because they, that's the way of certifying that you own it, let's say. The companies are sort of having forward-looking greed, because they know that in 10 years' time, they'll be able to sell a virtual version of that console that they sold you physically 15 years ago, and then those games again, which you're only going to be able to download them in you.
I'd say maybe. If there are people sitting around a boardroom somewhere that are doing that level of planned obsolescence, and there probably are, that's an intriguing way to think about it, right? So as I can sell you the same thing on your 8-track, then on your cassette, then on a record,
right.
Then a
Disney was notorious download. With that, going video, from VHS yeah. to DVD yeah. and the special, well, you know, only think, available once every 10 years.
But I think, Michael, that's you just challenged that statement in a very reasonable yep. way. I think you're right to say that maybe we are all becoming so cynical about business practices and making assumptions. I think actually the statement here about preventing sort of archival access, preventing institutional work to preserve these systems and these games.
Yeah.
And we've talked before about mm-hmm. the work of some of the organizations that are rebuilding those CPUs in software so that they can reproduce all the quirks of that original Nintendo Entertainment System or original Atari 2600 or whatever. As a historian, I'm fascinated by it because they are points of cultural importance. Even if it's the incredibly bad E.T. game from the 1980s for the Atari that got thrown in a landfill, it's interesting now because of what happened yeah. and what the story was behind that.
Well, the preservation notion as a historian, I know this really appeals to you, and it does to me too, and it's done on a number of different levels because it's important to the culture and cultural heritage. If you think about architectural, historical embodiments, Charleston style houses that are very common in the U.S. city of Charleston have been emulated in lots of places, and they have a historical record for how they were built, the way their front porch approaches the street, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm in agreement with you. I think there is a cultural preservation that's important because many of these games, books, movies, more. Demand a degree of historical preservation, while at the same time also from a copyright perspective, and I get this too as a creator, because we are creators here too, what we're creating today, we're not charging anyone for it, so you're welcome.
But it is copyrighted.
But it is a piece of creativity. And, you know, maybe someone 100 years from now who's listening to the three of us chat is finding some small degree of value from this discussion, but maybe not, right?
Well,
and it's our right to hold that up for ourselves because it is something that we have created and brought into the world.
You know who also loves sort of looking back at things nostalgically, and that's Peloton, because you look at this new game they've come out with, and they're basically reproducing Tron Light Cycles.
Exactly. I thought that was it.
Yeah, that was my sense too. And I would say it's high time that Peloton actually is coming into a more gamified approach, not just dealing with badges, not just dealing with competing against other people or participating in a virtual space with other Peloton riders, but to do so in more of a game. And Michael, this kind of reminds me of some of the ghost mode and other types of things that we had articulated in some of the patent work that we had done, where yes, you can race against yourself, or you can race against someone who doesn't exist anymore. And there's some value into that as well, because that's preservation of people.
What I found interesting about it, though, is also given their current business situation, right? Mm. The fact that they've kind of hit peak device, how do you keep value? And we had the good discussion, was it a couple of weeks ago, on why do you have these long games? It's about continuing the value of your purchase over time, even if you're not charging more for the additional, but just keep them engaged with your brand, keep them engaged with your product. And I see that because some people maybe don't want the instructor yelling at them, okay, breathe, okay, you can do it, et cetera. And they get more enjoyment out of the game aspect of it. So.
Well, shout out to The Verge here, because they've done some very interesting linking to other stories that I'd also missed. I saw the Peloton one, but until I read deeply into it, I missed a couple of other parts to this, which is that Google, we've known for a long time that Google Stadia was kind of in question as a long-term effort, but they evidently have demoted the importance of Stadia and are making the streaming gaming technology they've built as part of Stadia available. So they're moving and they're talking about Peloton and Lane Break being powered by Google Stream, which is underneath Stadia. So Lane Break, the thing we've just been talking about. The other thing that they highlight here is the other aspects of VR games, and they call out Les Mills, the boxing gym, or the gym, I should say, where they've come out with a VR game for the Meta Quest called Body Combat VR. So really pushing the fitness aspects of this technology. But I think we should probably move on to our last few links. What do you, I think?
Sure.
Yeah,
I think we've got time to wrap up.
Yeah, well, so why don't we wrap up with the one, Michael, that got you most excited, shall we?
Well, I don't know which one of these two got me most excited, but I'll hit both very quickly. One of my brother's favorite games was BioShock, which, if you've not played it, is kind of a really cool cinematic Doom-like game underwater. That's how I'll describe it. There's more complexity to the gameplay than that. Looks like they're gonna finally make a movie out of it. There's rumors happening along that path. But if you like that kind of cool cinematic cartoon world and movies, what you really should be interested in is the fact that Bloom County may come out as a movie soon, which I know I was a big fan back in the day, and we were discussing before the show today that Bloom County was not maybe a little niche for our products. For our product, yeah, that's right. For our listeners,
our podcast,
Yeah, I have words.
I took a look at the picture and it reminded me. I vaguely recognized it, but the art style reminded me of Doonesbury, which is what I was familiar with from that sort of era. I don't remember Bloom County being a thing here in the UK, but maybe other folks will remember. I certainly recognize the cat in the image, but that's probably just from a meme worthy. Aspect of being on the internet.
Well, it'll come back for sure in a big way because Hack is going to show up as soon as this movie hits, and I am personally excited about seeing Opus Crocus, who is the death metal tuba playing version of the penguin, getting on t-shirts yet again.
Yes. Party on, Bill.
All right, so with that, you've now squandered another perfectly good half hour with
yes.
us, and we're glad that you did.
We appreciate it.
Yes, and we hope that you find a couple of things that maybe you didn't deeply see or notice when you're going through your feeds this week. If you see some of those, shoot them our way. We'd love to take them on board and talk about them next week
and if you,
on our next edition.
If you've been listening and you've been shouting at your pod device, Michael, you're wrong. Because obviously those are the only people that would be wrong would be somebody called Michael. Then, you know, just share that with the world on the internet. We're on Twitter. Tell us what they got wrong. I'd love to know.
Oh, Reg, games@work_biz.
Yes. Or just reinforce what Andy got right. We would appreciate that, too.
Yes.
That is the correct answer.
Well, fellas, we will see you again. We might not see anybody.
We will see each other again.
Podcast. We'll see each other again when we record our next.
My ocular implants will hopefully stay present
and functioning. All right. Thanks, everybody. Catch you next time.
See ya. You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song "Big Blue." You can follow us on Twitter at games@work_biz or at our website at games@work.biz. Metaversing.
Metaversing. Metaversing.
You both got it wrong. It's
Levioso.
It's metaverse. Metaverse. You can't say metaverse. There's no. You're not pronouncing metaverse. any of the consonants. It's metaverse.
What about? Do we need to be meta mates now too?
Oh my goodness, that was great.